Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black.
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much. And I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, is a magnificent book, and I've said many times, though I think many people read it incorrectly, they read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies, an analysis of African culture and of African history, with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interest in as a people, and in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures, together with a supporting set of ideas and values, is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you are free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Williams, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of, in what way did they meet our needs, and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power of studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideas and values that lay the basis for culture. Kluckhorn, an anthropologist, indicated that culture and he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of the guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is European, Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality, because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest, you see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. The gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote about the fact that it took him, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education. What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interests of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face. You see, I categorize and I classify, but I categorize and I classify in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures. And I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. Socially, culture patterns the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way, implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you could go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that, because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way and interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the history of man. And yet we've had economies for hundreds and thousands of years before money came into existence. So ultimately then, an economy must have something to do with the way people choose to cooperate with each other and relate to each other. It is out of this that an economy develops, and it is out of this that power develops, you see. So if you have a culture, the culture is going to provide patterns of relating and interacting. It's these patterns of relating and interacting that permits a people who belong to a culture to solve the problems that confront them. So you see, again, it's just not something, as the sister indicated, that you wear, you see, or the speech that you make, you see. It ultimately has to be about relating in a particular structured sort of way. This is what culture is socially. It is very important to keep in mind that a culture is, to a significant extent, a historical product. Let's talk a second about identity. Identity is the social and personal outcome of the or product of an identification process. According to Bandura, this identification process is a process in which new responses are acquired and existing repertoires of behaviors are modified to some extent as a result of subjection to direct or indirect conditioning procedures. All cultures condition the people that belong to them. All cultures ultimately must have some means of rewarding and punishing behavior. And that's another thing we don't want to face, you know. We want everybody to do right just because it means doing right. And this is what I said earlier when we talk about these conspiracies and these boule. You're not going to win this game if you don't have a means of neutralizing people and rewarding people, you see. and controlling people. The reason why, as I've often said, the very first thing that we must do if we are to transform our children is to get control of them. Yeah. And we must become their primary rewarders and punishers. We must determine the conditions under which they are socialized if we want to create the kinds of people we need to solve our problems. You are not going to solve your problems giving the control of your children over to other people. And yet we sit around here hoping every day, after pushing our children and ourselves into the faces of white folk, into the faces of our enemies, that these people, by luck or some means, will happen to be the kind of people we need for ourselves. The very point and process of education is to create the people you need for your benefit. And if a culture is going to educate your children, it then will educate them to benefit whom? Itself, not you. Not you. You must bring your children under your own control, and you must be in control of the conditioning process. This is what it's about. If you don't have control of that, then really you're not going to have control of the children. Because identification with a culture, becoming cultured or enculturated, is the result of a culture approving and disapproving, of rewarding and not rewarding, and of sometimes even punishing, to ultimately shape the individual in a way that it benefits the culture and ultimately the individual, him or herself. And this is what identity is about. It's about patterning, the patterning of thoughts, feelings, and actions after other persons who serve as models. You even learn to love. You know, we think that love is something natural, just flows out of us automatically. And yet we have a number of cultures who did not base marriage and these other things, as I've told you before, on romantic love. Mm-mm. Even romantic love is taught and learned. Yeah. Yeah. People are taught how to feel. And we do it all the time. You shouldn't feel that way. And often, in order for us to be in the state that we are in today as people, we have to be out of our minds. We literally have to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be backwards. It is necessary for us to be maladjusted. It is necessary for us to be disunited. It is necessary for us to be self-hating. It is necessary for us to be filled with an inferiority complex. In a world where the European is essentially about 10% of the world's population, if that 10% is to continue to rule over the other 90%, it must keep that 90% out of its mind. It must keep that 90% in a state of deception. It must keep that 90% filled with a feeling of powerlessness and incompetence. If this 10% is to continue to consume more than 60% of the world's resources, if this 10% is to continue to rob African, Asian, and other nations of their material wealth, then it must keep those people in a state of maladjustment. And this implies then that no matter how much integration you may bring about, the feeling of inferiority must be a constant in the black personality. No matter how many people you run for president, no matter how many mayors you get elected, no matter how many people you get on the board of IBM and the others, the basic sense of inferiority, the basic sense of dependency must remain a constant in the black mind. And I will indicate this, and I think this study, which occurred now some 40 years later, shows this to be the case. Dr. Clark shows surprise that after all of this time, this feeling is still there. I would not, and I don't think any student who's basically looked at the necessity of black people being out of their minds as being the foundation of European dominance would not be surprised. I think it was quite predictable.
Remember, these children have this feeling of inferiority basically from the end of their second years. You can pick up this sense of inferiority as early as 3, 3.5 years old. So it starts very early. And I'm still working through my mind the implications of that finding. We are talking about preschool children, not only children that are in school, but children who are having this feeling prior to school. This would, of course, indicate that to a degree that our environment is saturated with racism through TV, through the various media, through the pictures I put on walls, through the unconscious and conscious state can influence the child's behavior and attitude starting in the womb itself. And I often start my developmental classes not with the prenatal period and how egg meets sperm, but with why do you have children in the first place? Because the reasons you have children will influence their development. It will influence them from the time they're in your womb until, of course, the day they die upon this earth. It would indicate then that to a degree and in some way the black community itself has been induced in helping to bring about a feeling of inferiority in its children. To a good extent, it is not so much the actions of racism that destroy us, the discrimination by white folk and Europeans, the kind of hatred that they express toward us as people that destroys us and gives us an inferiority complex. It is to a good degree how we as people react to these actions. Whether we believe the propaganda or not, whether we believe what the European actually has said, we cannot often control the behavior of other people, but we do have a greater control over how we react to that behavior. And to a good extent, the challenge of an Afrocentric education is to educate us in our tendencies to react. To a good extent, it would mean that the actions of racism apparently have induced some of us to accept racist propaganda and to really believe it, to internalize it. Once we internalize the propaganda, then we become social agents for the racists themselves. And to a good extent, then, the black family, once it internalizes the propaganda of Eurocentric racist, becomes a social agent for the racist and begins to produce the kinds of children that the racists want from the time of conception onward. It becomes instructive, you see, to look at a family not as something that just raises children, but a family, to a good extent, is the social agent of the society. It produces the kinds of children that the society says it needs and wants. The family looks out at the opportunity structure, at its own social position. It looks out at what it views as the future for its children, for its group, for its nation. And it inculcates those views into its children and rears its children in terms of those views, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously. And in that way, it begins to create the children for the society. In a heavily segregated society, for instance, if your black boy or girl would have said some years ago that they wanted to be president of the United States or that they were going to be president of the United States, how many of us, by being realistic, would have discouraged that view? You know, ain't no black man going to be this or no black woman going to be that. Be real. And in the service of being real, by saying, well, I don't want him to be disappointed. I want to save him from racism and save him from the recognition one day that there are limitations to his aspirations, we quietly steer them toward a trade or a skill. Get this and get a job. So you, what's happening there? While it may have a realistic basis in a certain sort of way, you are also at the same time, though, creating the child's aspirations. You're also creating the child's motivations. You're creating the child's view of itself in line with the way the society is structured. A true Afrocentric family not only relates to his children in terms of reality, but it relates to his children in terms of idealism. It relates in the sense that there is a world that it is an African family and we as an African people want to bring about. While the black man may not be president of the United States, it does not mean that he cannot rule the world. The true Afrocentric family then not only raises his children in terms of the so-called social realities, because it recognizes that social realities are things that men create themselves. And therefore it raises children to create a reality suitable to the advancement and development of black people. But an unconscious black family, an unconscious people, a people who've fallen victim to racism, a people who've fallen victim to a sense of inferiority, then will produce the kind of inferior children that the white society needs to continue its dominance in the world. And in this way, then, the black family and the black community and black leadership becomes allied with the dominant group and with the Eurocentric group. It is this kind of thing that we must come to become conscious of and to defeat consciously. I'm going to give you a little taste of what I'm writing about in my current book. I want to indicate that black maladjustment is not just a suffering in the soul of black people. It's not just a feeling of inferiority in which over which the individual has to get. It's not just a feeling of alienation that you get over by going to a therapist, that you get over by attending various therapeutic sessions. Black maladjustment is functionally necessary for the world as it is currently constituted. Black maladjustment is a political factor, and I often try to get across to people the understanding that when we go to these universities and these schools, one of the greatest deceptions that's run upon us is the idea that the things that we are taught in these schools are non-political, that they are neutral, that they are somehow universal. And of course, the whites run a beautiful game on us when they, for instance, name their courses without putting their ethnicity in front of them. They don't say white psychology, white education, white economics, white physics, white chemistry, you know. And we often naively then assume because they're called economics, psychology, anthropology, that means we are in a course that has general and universal meanings. And we are made to think that we are odd when we call a course black studies, that there's something wrong with it. But every course in the American college and university and in the American educational establishment is a course in white studies, ladies and gentlemen. And every course in every discipline is designed for essentially the same thing, to maintain white dominance. We must be very conscious of that, and we must recognize that a major part of the education of our children and of ourselves is the fact that we have to politicize the courses that we're taking, even science, even physics and chemistry. So a lot of people think, well, you know, we're talking about atoms and molecules and this and that, and they have no ethnicity and they have no politics. In a fundamental way, you may be right, but on another level, there's a problem with that. Science, scientific thinking, and technological development does not just develop in the head of some genius. It's not the result of some scientific genius who happened to strike upon some major discovery. Scientific discovery and technological development take place within a political social structure. You have to have a political system, a system of social relations, an economic system in order that science and technology develop and flourish. They do not flourish in a vacuum. Therefore, it is not enough just to teach your children physics and chemistry. You must teach them the politics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them the economics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them how a system must organize itself politically and socially such that physical and chemical research take place. It is not enough for us to educate African boys and girls in science and technology so that African can catch up with the Europeans. You will never catch up with the European just by knowing science and technology. Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have to finance technological research. You have to pay scientists to do research. People just don't do research for nothing. If you run the latest physics experiment, you would have to produce a cyclotron with a circumference of some 20 or 30 miles around that costs billions of dollars. And if you're then talking about catching up with the Europeans scientifically, then you must catch up with the Europeans and surpass them, what? Economically. If your children are to work for you and give their scientific genius to the advancement of black people, then we as black people must give them an economic, social, and political foundation in which their gifts can be realized and handed over to us as a people. And therefore, merely to teach chemistry and physics as some neutral subject, as some body of knowledge unrelated to everything else going on into the world, is to be miseducated. That is one of the reasons why we have a country filled, as black people, with chemists, with engineers, machinists, and yet we don't seem to be able to export one gun to South Africa. We don't seem to be able to make one bomb. We have generals and sergeants and green berets and rangers and all of the rest, and yet we are unable to train one guerrilla or anything else to fight for their liberation in this world because there's a lack of social organization. It is not enough just to have knowledge. It is not enough just to have money. Money and knowledge must be organized in order to be effective. And knowledge, in order to flourish and be actualized in some concrete advancement for people, must be based ultimately on social relations between those people. So there must be a social structure. And while your children are learning science and mathematics, they must learn to love themselves and to love one another, and to cooperate one with the other. Or else they'll have an Afrocentric mind, but they will still have to go down to IBM and Xerox and do their work. And ultimately then, they will still be racked by a sense of inferiority and dependency. So we must keep that in mind. Let me quickly state here then that the sense of inferiority in black people and the other problems we talk about will not be removed by assimilation. They will not be removed by integration. They will not be removed by Jesse Jackson being elected president of the United States. They will not be removed by the election of other black politicians. And that doesn't say that Jesse Jackson shouldn't be elected, and it doesn't say that other politicians should not be elected. I'm saying, though, we cannot look at those things as being the sole basis for removing and solving the kinds of problems that we have. Because maladjustment is not merely a malady of the individual personality. Maladjustment is functional for a system. That system sometimes can be a family. Do you know sometimes a family is held together by a sick person? It is a scapegoat, a quote-unquote black sheep around which the family defines itself. Sometimes a husband and wife keep a relationship because one of them is sick. And when one goes to the psychiatrist somewhere and try to get better, decide that they're going to change their life, the relationship breaks up. An And often families will subtly pull a member back into alcoholism and other kinds of problems as a way of maintaining itself, even though it may be claiming aloud that it's really concerned with getting the person well. Because often the sickness of one individual works to the advantage of another one. And I will say then, when you see a society producing a lot of illness, the illness must be functional for that society. The sick people must be playing a very valuable role in that system. In other words, people don't drive you crazy for nothing. There's some benefit involved. Let me read this section then. The question that often goes unasked or unanswered from a general theoretical point of view is one that's asked, what familial societal role is played by the maladjusted personality? Why are we sick and why do we have the inferiority complex that we have as people? If the maladjusted personality is created and maintained by a social system, whether that system be dyadic, that is a system where there's a relationship between two people, familial or society, then it is reasonable to assume that such a personality, that is the maladjusted personality, is created and maintained because it is needed, because it is essential to the functioning of that system or some segment of that system. The maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to another. I've often said, of course, one of the problems we have as people is that we are a created people. We are a creation of the Eurocentric Dr. Frankenstein. And we have been created to serve the purpose of Europeans. One of the major goals of an Afrocentric education and of Afrocentric development is that we become self-developed, that we determine what our personality traits will be, that we determine our destiny and our direction, and not be determined by our reactionary relationship to some other people. Often a maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to parental and familial self-image, to societal, economic, political values and goals. If the maladjusted personality is a defensive and avoidant one, and such defensive and avoidant tendencies are deemed neurotic, then they are created to defend the individual against neurotic demands and to protect it, to help him avoid a reality that is painful. However, that doesn't mean that the individual is not engaged also in serving the society. Often, we look at a neurotic person as a defensive personality, as a personality that is avoidant. It seeks to avoid certain responsibilities and certain reactions and certain realities. We must also see, though, that personality in defending itself, in avoiding certain realities, actually serves another group or another person. I was doing a lecture here on self-hatred. And in the very first lecture, I dealt with the image of the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. And I made the statement that you had to beware of a church such that when you walk into it, the first thing you see is a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus back behind the altar. That church is lying to you, and that church is going to help send you to hell. How did I say that? Because first of all, there's nowhere in the Bible that a description of that Jesus has ever been given. And secondly, that Bible strictly states that graven images should not be made, and it's done. And one minister jumped up, offended because of that statement, and took the statement personally. And I'm a minister in the such and such a church, and I took a course under Dr. Cone at Columbia University, and you know, just laid it all out for me, you know. And objected to it as if I were attacking the minister directly when I was dealing with the concept and I was dealing with the psychology of having gods painted in alien forms and how that induces self-hatred and maintains self-hatred in the people. How praying to a white man is damaging to black people. And how thinking of God as a white man is damaging to black people. I'm dealing with the concept here. Yet she felt a need to defend what she thought of as herself and her profession. But in defending herself, she actually defended the system. She actually defended the status quo. And many of us then, as neurotics, you see, as we engage in our neurotic and maladjusted behavior and defend our egos and defend our vanities and defend our pride, actually support and hold up the system. It's embarrassed or justified the abusing family. And how we, in many instances, end up justifying the system that abuses us. Integration itself indicates that, wanting to live and be loved and lay around with people who destroyed us and enslaved us and given us the greatest pain in the world. So that's what we call in psychology the love of the aggressor. To the people you want to love most are the people who've done the most damage to you. Unhealthy personalities cannot be created by healthy environments. Since the unhealthy of an individual or group can result in the relative health, wealth, security, and power and sense of identity of another individual or group, then it serves the interests of the latter group. In other words, the unhealth of the black community serves the health and wealth of the white community. Just as the sickness of the drug addict serves the health and wealth of the pusher. So in a sense then, it becomes in the interest of the pusher to keep the addict, of course, addicted, even though he claims he's doing him a service and a favor. The latter group becomes dependent, that is the unhealthy group, comes to need the unhealthiness, and that is the dominant group really becomes dependent and comes to need the unhealthiness of the former. If the health of the former means a reduction in the dominance of the latter, then the latter resists the health of the former despite its pretensions to the contrary. In other words, when we even see assimilationism, we don't have time to talk about it here tonight, but in many ways assimilationism and integrationism is really another prompt for the maintenance of white power. And while we thought that we bought it in to a great extent, I would argue that to a good extent the white ruling class helped to push it as well because it also helps to maintain the white ruling class in power. When you have a minority of people, such as the European, often in order to stay in power they must recruit from the very people they oppress. And therefore they will call up from those people certain talented people or other types who then will identify with their masters and help them to maintain the control over the masses. This often will be called integration and will often be called desegregation. But ultimately, if you look very closely, you'll notice one thing, that the real power relationship between those two groups has not changed. I talk about a number of things we call constants. That if we look closely in the relationship, at the relationship between Europeans and Africans, we will note that there are certain basic things that have not changed despite all of the other things we look at. Despite integrationism, despite political and social change, there are things that are still basically the same and have been the same for the last 400 years. The real power of black people, particularly if you talk about military power, has not changed fundamentally since the very time we met the European. You may find African countries now with jet planes and tanks that they bought from Europeans, by the way, and still have yet to make. And you may think then that the Africans have entered into a modern era in warfare and so forth, but I would dare say that there's not a single African country that could really protect the interests of black people against European power, particularly as that power moves out into space and can rain down on the African continent bombs and laser weapons and other weapons of various types. And African countries having no anti-ballistic system, no Star Wars system, no system to fight war in space is literally defenseless. and yet they may fly the latest American jets, and in the face of American and European war power, we are still ultimately defenseless. That has not changed fundamentally in 400 years, ladies and gentlemen. The European economic control of this globe fundamentally has not changed either. The European control of information has not changed fundamentally either. The European control of definition, the definition of reality, the definition of what is and is not, has not changed fundamentally either. That has been the case for a long time. The European tendency to degrade things African has not changed as well. You may now have a degree in computer technology. You may now have a job that pays you $40,000 to $50,000 to $60,000 a year. But your fundamental relationship to the European has not changed one whit from the fundamental relationship between our African forefathers and his European slave master. For as you work your computers, you still work to the profits of Europeans. And so the fact that we've moved into the executive offices does not mean we've moved into power. Does not mean that the fundamental power relationship between Europeans and Africans have changed one bit. As a matter of fact, the moving of blacks into the executive offices is an effort to maintain that power and to obscure that power behind a form of neocolonialism. I don't think it is an accident that the desegregation movement and the assimilationist movement in America parallel the neocolonial movement in Africa. As I often tell my classes, you as black students are now being educated to put a black face on white power and to help deceive your people into thinking because you got a job, we have moved forward as a people. Let's then just take a quick look at the functions of maladjustment and why you cannot get blacks, why it is important that blacks never get out of their sickness. You ever wondered why the more social workers you produce, the crazier people get? The more psychologists you produce, the crazier people get. Have you ever wondered about that? I lost a job challenging whites about that. Why you, as a white man, whom these crazy people have permitted to be chairman of the Department of Predominantly Hispanic and Black College, why do you as a black man, a white man, continue to try to bring these psychologists in here when you know that this psychology is not doing the black and Hispanic community one whit of good? He could not disagree with that. How do you pretend to judge the qualifications of black people for teaching other black people and Hispanic teachers and Hispanic students, when you admit every day in the New York educational system that you don't know how to educate black children? We have a group of people who lament about their inability to educate black children, how black children are so-called uncontrollable and ineducable and all of that, and yet they want to sit on a board and determine who is qualified and not qualified. We have this insult downtown where these white dogs are going to try to determine who should be the chancellor of New York City schools, and yet have admitted that they cannot educate black children. And we'll sit there and let them try to lay the foundation and tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to be. How do you qualify to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to do? You have not demonstrated that you are capable of educating black people, but yet there are a lot of us who want to sit back and talk about standards and degrees and all this other nonsense that the people who clearly admitted that they failed have laid upon us. And yet we have a lot of this going on in the system. But this kind of stuff must happen if black people are to continue to be subordinated. How is it functional? The captive African maladjustment justifies European dominance and exploitation. Because we are crazy, because we are criminals, because we are addicts, because we are that, the Europeans have a right to put their police in our community. They have a right to run the welfare agencies that keep us crazy, by the way. They have a right to intrude into our cultural families and personal lives. Why? because, you see, they are maladjusted. They have learning deficiencies. They have this and that. Therefore, we're coming in to help and treat them in some sort of way. We are bringing in foreign aid. We are calling on the IMF to study and regulate their national economies and so forth. So you will see the so-called sickness and dependency and lagging in development and all of these other kinds of things every day are justifications for the Europeans to intrude upon African life and seek to control that life. And when we accept their definitions, we accept their dominance. We ask for their dominance, and we see their dominance as some kind of aid to us. Yet, when we look some 40 years later, we are in the same position or in a worse position than before. How do we solve it? Asking more of it. Well, let's get more degrees. Let's see that the teachers get more degrees. Even though the more degrees they get, the worse the education has become. But what's the solution? Send them back to school for more. The more money that's been pumped into school, what happens? The worse the education has got. What's the solution? Let's put more money into school. Idiotic solutions all over the place. But you see, you cannot expect a neurotic to think normally. That's the essence of being what? Neurotic. If you thought normally, behaved normally, you wouldn't be a neurotic, would you? So being maladjusted justifies European dominance, rationalizes Eurocentric treatment, as I just said, of African people, and thereby reduces their guilt and self-condemnatory feelings for behaving toward the African in ways contrary to their stated political and constitutional, ethical, moral, religious principles. You know, these great Christians and these great people who believe in equality. How do you believe in equality? You know, the greatest problem in this country was, how do you believe in the equality of man and yet enslave a group of men? How do you believe in this and mistreat and discriminate? In order to get out of that dilemma then, you must make those people what? Less than men. Less than human. You see? So then in that way you can justify what you're doing. They're not fully human. They're not fully men. They're not fully intelligent. They're not fully capable of self-government. They're not fully capable of guiding themselves. Therefore, it's only incumbent on us, those of us who are lucky enough to be more intelligent and divinely sent to rule over men, to take care of them. It is incumbent upon us to take up what? The white man's burden, which happens to be the black man. But actually, the other way. We need more linear thinking at this point. In order for us to be in the state that we are in today as people, we have to be out of our minds. We literally have to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be backwards. It is necessary for us to be maladjusted. It is necessary for us to be disunited. It is necessary for us to be self-hating. It is necessary for us to be filled with an inferiority complex. In a world where the European is essentially about 10% of the world's population, if that 10% is to continue to rule over the other 90%, it must keep that 90% out of its mind. It must keep that 90% in a state of deception. It must keep that 90% filled with a feeling of powerlessness and incompetence. If this 10% is to continue to consume more than 60% of the world's resources, if this 10% is to continue to rob African, Asian, and other nations of their material wealth, then it must keep those people in a state of maladjustment. And this implies then that no matter how much integration you may bring about, the feeling of inferiority must be a constant in the black personality. No matter how many people you run for president, no matter how many mayors you get elected, no matter how many people you get on the board of IBM and the others, the basic sense of inferiority, the basic sense of dependency must remain a constant in the black mind. And I will indicate this, and I think this study which occurred now some 40 years later, shows this to be the case. Dr. Clark shows surprise that after all of this time, this feeling is still there. I would not, and I don't think any student who's basically looked at the necessity of black people being out of their minds as being the foundation of European dominance, would not be surprised. I think it was quite predictable. Remember, these children have this feeling of inferiority basically from the end of their second years. You can pick up this sense of inferiority as early as 3, 3.5 years old. So it starts very early. And I'm still working through my mind the implications of that finding. We are talking about preschool children, not only children that are in school, but children who are having this feeling prior to school. This would, of course, indicate that to a degree that our environment is saturated with racism through TV, through the various media, through the pictures our parents have on the walls, through the unconscious and conscious state can influence the child's behavior and attitude starting in the womb itself. And I often start my developmental classes not with the prenatal period and how egg meets sperm, but with why do you have children in the first place? Because the reasons you have children will influence their development. It will influence them from the time they're in your womb until, of course, the day they die upon this earth. It would indicate then that to a degree and in some way the black community itself has been induced in helping to bring about a feeling of inferiority in its children. To a good extent, it is not so much the actions of racism that destroy us, the discrimination by white folk and Europeans, the kind of hatred that they express toward us as people that destroys us and gives us an inferiority complex. It is to a good degree how we as people react to these actions. Whether we believe the propaganda or not, whether we believe what the European actually has said, we cannot often control the behavior of other people, but we do have a greater control over how we react to that behavior. And to a good extent, the challenge of an Afrocentric education is to educate us in our tendencies to react. To a good extent, it would mean that the actions of racism apparently have induced some of us to accept racist propaganda and to really believe it, to internalize it. Once we internalize the propaganda, then we become social agents for the racists themselves. And to a good extent, then, the black family, once it internalizes the propaganda of Eurocentric racist, becomes a social agent for the racist and begins to produce the kinds of children that the racists want from the time of conception onward. It becomes instructive, you see, to look at a family not as something that just raises children, but a family, to a good extent, is the social agent of the society. It produces the kinds of children that the society says it needs and wants. The family looks out at the opportunity structure, at its own social position. It looks out at what it views as the future for its children, for its group, for its nation. And it inculcates those views into its children and rears its children in terms of those views, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously. And in that way, it begins to create the children for the society. In a heavily segregated society, for instance, if your black boy or girl would have said some years ago that they wanted to be president of the United States or that they were going to be president of the United States, how many of us by being realistic, would have discouraged that view. You know, ain't no black man going to be this or no black woman going to be that. Be real. And in the service of being real, by saying, well, I don't want him to be disappointed. I want to save him from racism and save him from the recognition one day that there are limitations to his aspirations. We quietly steer them toward a trade or a skill. Get this and get a job. So you, what's happening there? While it may have a realistic basis in a certain sort of way, you are also at the same time, though, creating the child's aspirations. You're also creating the child's motivations. You're creating the child's view of itself in line with the way the society is structured. A true Afrocentric family not only relates to his children in terms of reality, but it relates to his children in terms of idealism. It relates in the sense that there is a world that it is an African family and we as an African people want to bring about. While the black man may not be president of the United States, it does not mean that he cannot rule the world. The true Afrocentric family then not only raises his children in terms of the so-called social realities, because it recognizes that social realities are things that men create themselves. And therefore it raises children to create a reality suitable to the advancement and development of black people. But an unconscious black family, an unconscious people, a people who've fallen victim to racism, a people who've fallen victim to a sense of inferiority, then will produce the kind of inferior children that the white society needs to continue its dominance in the world. And in this way, then, the black family and the black community and black leadership becomes allied with the dominant group and with the Eurocentric group. It is this kind of thing that we must come to become conscious of and to defeat consciously. I'm going to give you a little taste of what I'm writing about in my current book. I want to indicate that black maladjustment is not just a suffering in the soul of black people. It's not just a feeling of inferiority in which over which the individual has to get. It's not just a feeling of alienation that you get over by going to a therapist, that you get over by attending various therapeutic sessions. Black maladjustment is functionally necessary for the world as it is currently constituted. Black maladjustment is a political factor, and I often try to get across to people the understanding that when we go to these universities and these schools, one of the greatest deceptions that's run upon us is the idea that the things that we are taught in these schools are non-political, that they are neutral, that they are somehow universal. And of course, the whites run a beautiful game on us when they, for instance, name their courses without putting their ethnicity in front of them. They don't say white psychology, white education, white economics, white physics, white chemistry, you know. And we often naively then assume because they're called economics, psychology, anthropology, that means we are in a course that has general and universal meanings. And we are made to think that we are odd when we call a course black studies, that there's something wrong with it. But every course in the American college and university and in the American educational establishment is a course in white studies, ladies and gentlemen. And every course in every discipline is designed for essentially the same thing, to maintain white dominance. We must be very conscious of that, and we must recognize that a major part of the education of our children and of ourselves is the fact that we have to politicize the courses that we're taking, even science, even physics and chemistry. So a lot of people think, well, you know, we're talking about atoms and molecules and this and that, and they have no ethnicity and they have no politics. on the fundamental, in a fundamental way, you may be right, but on another level, there's a problem with that. Science, scientific thinking, and technological development does not just develop in the head of some genius. It's not the result of some scientific genius who happened to strike upon some major discovery. Scientific discovery and technological development take place within a political social structure. You have to have a political system, a system of social relations, an economic system in order that science and technology develop and flourish. They do not flourish in a vacuum. Therefore, it is not enough just to teach your children physics and chemistry. You must teach them the politics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them the economics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them how a system must organize itself politically and socially such that physical and chemical research take place. It is not enough for us to educate African boys and girls in science and technology so that Africans can catch up with the Europeans. You will never catch up with the European just by knowing science and technology. Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have to finance technological research. You have to pay scientists to do research. People just don't do research for nothing. If you run the latest physics experiment, you would have to produce a cyclotron with a circumference of some 20 or 30 miles around that costs billions of dollars. And if you're then talking about catching up with the Europeans scientifically, then you must catch up with the Europeans and surpass them, what? Economically. If your children are to work for you and give their scientific genius to the advancement of black people, then we as black people must give them an economic, social, and political foundation in which their gifts can be realized and handed over to us as a people. And therefore, merely to teach chemistry and physics as some neutral subject, as some body of knowledge unrelated to everything else going on into the world, is to be miseducated. That is one of the reasons why we have a country filled, as black people, with chemists, with engineers, machinists, and yet we don't seem to be able to export one gun to South Africa. We don't seem to be able to make one bomb. We have generals and sergeants and green berets and rangers and all of the rest, and yet we are unable to train one guerrilla or anything else to fight for their liberation in this world because there's a lack of social organization. It is not enough just to have knowledge. It is not enough just to have money. Money and knowledge must be organized in order to be effective. And knowledge, in order to flourish and be actualized in some concrete advancement for people, must be based ultimately on social relations between those people. So there must be a social structure. And while your children are learning science and mathematics, they must learn to love themselves and to love one another and to cooperate one with the other. Or else they'll have an Afrocentric mind, but they will still have to go down to IBM and Xerox and do their work. And ultimately then, they will still be racked by a sense of inferiority and dependency. So we must keep that in mind. Let me quickly state here then that the sense of inferiority in black people and the other problems we talk about will not be removed by assimilation. They will not be removed by integration. They will not be removed by Jesse Jackson being elected president of the United States. They will not be removed by the election of other black politicians. And that doesn't say that Jesse Jackson shouldn't be elected, and it doesn't say that other politicians should not be elected. I'm saying, though, we cannot look at those things as being the sole basis for removing and solving the kinds of problems that we have. Because maladjustment is not merely a malady of the individual personality. Maladjustment is functional for a system. That system sometimes can be a family. Do you know sometimes a family is held together by a sick person? It is a scapegoat, a quote-unquote black sheep, around which the family defines itself. Sometimes a husband and wife keep the relationship because one of them is sick. And when one goes to the psychiatrist somewhere and try to get better, decide that they're going to change their life, the relationship breaks up. And often families will subtly pull a member back into alcoholism and other kinds of problems as a way of maintaining itself, even though it may be claiming aloud that it's really concerned with getting the person well. Because often the sickness of one individual works to the advantage of another one. And I will say then, when you see a society producing a lot of illness, the illness must be functional for that society. The sick people must be playing a very valuable role in that system. In other words, people don't drive you crazy for nothing. There's some benefit involved. Let me read this section then. The question that often goes unasked or unanswered from a general theoretical point of view is one that's asked, what familial societal role is played by the maladjusted personality? Why are we sick and why do we have the inferiority complex that we have as people? If the maladjusted personality is created and maintained by a social system, whether that system be dyadic, that is a system where there's a relationship between two people, familial or society, then it is reasonable to assume that such a personality, that is the maladjusted personality, is created and maintained because it is needed, because it is essential to the functioning of that system or some segment of that system. The maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to another. I've often said, of course, one of the problems we have as people is that we are a created people. We are a creation of the Eurocentric Dr. Frankenstein. And we have been created to serve the purpose of Europeans. One of the major goals of an Afrocentric education and of Afrocentric development is that we become self-developed. That we determine what our personality traits will be, that we determine our destiny and our direction, and not be determined by our reactionary relationship to some other people. Often a maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to parental and familial self-image, to societal, economic, political values and goals. If the maladjusted personality is a defensive and avoidant one, and such defensive and avoidant tendencies are deemed neurotic, then they are created to defend the individual against neurotic demands and to help him avoid a reality that is painful. However, that doesn't mean that the individual is not engaged also in serving the society. Often we look at a neurotic person as a defensive personality, as a personality that is avoidant. It seeks to avoid certain responsibilities and certain reactions and certain realities. We must also see, though, that personality in defending itself, in avoiding certain realities, actually serves another group or another person. I was doing a lecture here on self-hatred, and in the very first lecture, I dealt with the image of the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. And I made the statement that you have to beware of a church such that when you walk into it, the first thing you see is a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus back behind the altar. That church is lying to you. And that church is going to help send you to hell. How did I say that? Because first of all, there's nowhere in the Bible that a description of that Jesus has ever been given. And secondly, that Bible strictly states that graven images should not be made. And it's done. And one minister jumped up, offended because of that statement, and took the statement personally. And I'm a minister in the such and such a church, and I took a course under Dr. Cone at Columbia University, and, you know, just laid it all out for me, you know, and objected to it as if I were attacking the minister directly when I was dealing with the concept and I was dealing with the psychology of having gods painted in alien forms. And how that induces self-hatred and maintains self-hatred in the people. How praying to a white man is damaging to black people. And how thinking of God as a white man is damaging to black people. I'm dealing with the concept here. Yet she felt a need to defend what she thought of as herself and her profession. But in defending herself, she actually defended the system. She actually defended the status quo. And many of us then, as neurotics, you see, as we engage in our neurotic and maladjusted behavior and defend our egos and defend our vanities and defend our pride, actually support and hold up the system. It's imperative or justify the abusing family. And how we, in many instances, end up justifying a system that abuses us. Integration itself indicates that, wanting to live and be loved and lay around with people who destroyed us and enslaved us and given us the greatest pain in the world. So that's what we call in psychology the love of the aggressor. To the people you want to love most are the people who've done the most damage to you. Unhealthy personalities cannot be created by healthy environments. Since the unhealth of an individual or group can result in the relative health, wealth, security, and power and sense of identity of another individual or group, then it serves the interest of the latter group. In other words, the unhealth of the black community serves the health and wealth of the white community. Just as the sickness of the drug addict serves the health and wealth of the pusher. So in a sense then, it becomes in the interest of the pusher to keep the addict, of course, addicted, even though he claims he's doing him a service and a favor. The latter group becomes dependent, that is the unhealthy group, comes to need the unhealthiness, and that is the dominant group, really becomes dependent and comes to need the unhealthiness of the former. If the health of the former means a reduction in the dominance of the latter, then the latter resists the health of the former despite its pretensions to the contrary. In other words, when we even see assimilationism, we don't have time to talk about it here tonight, but in many ways assimilationism and integrationism is really another prompt for the maintenance of white power. And while we thought that we bought it in to a great extent, I would argue that to a good extent the white ruling class helped to push it as well because it also helps to maintain the white ruling class in power. When you have a minority of people, such as the European, often in order to stay in power they must recruit from the very people they oppress. And therefore they will call up from those people certain talented people or other types who then will identify with their masters and helped in to maintain the control over the masses. This often will be called integration and will often be called desegregation. But ultimately, if you look very closely, you'll notice one thing, that the real power relationship between those two groups has not changed. I talk about a number of things we call constants, that if we look closely in the relationship, at the relationship between Europeans and Africans, we will note that there are certain basic things that have not changed despite all of the other things we look at. Despite integrationism, despite political and social change, there are things that are still basically the same and have been the same for the last 400 years. The real power of black people, particularly if you talk about military power, has not changed fundamentally since the very time we met the European. You may find African countries now with jet planes and tanks that they bought from Europeans, by the way, and still have yet to make. And you may think then that the Africans have entered into a modern era in warfare and so forth. But I would dare say that there's not a single African country that could really protect the interests of black people against European power, particularly as that power moves out into space and can ring and can rain down on the African continent bombs and laser weapons and other weapons of various types. And African countries having no anti-ballistic system, no Star Wars system, no system to fight war in space is literally defenseless. And yet they may fly the latest American jets, and in the face of American and European war power, we are still ultimately defenseless. That has not changed fundamentally in 400 years, ladies and gentlemen. The European economic control of this globe fundamentally has not changed either. The European control of information has not changed fundamentally either. The European control of definition, the definition of reality, the definition of what is and is not, has not changed fundamentally either. That has been the case for a long time. The European tendency to degrade things African has not changed as well. You may now have a degree in computer technology. You may now have a job that pays you $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, but your fundamental relationship to the European has not changed one whit from the fundamental relationship between our African forefathers and his European slave master. For as you work your computers, you still work to the profit of Europeans. And so the fact that we've moved into the executive offices does not mean we've moved into power. Does not mean that the fundamental power relationship between Europeans and Africans have changed one bit. As a matter of fact, the moving of blacks into the executive offices is an effort to maintain that power and to obscure that power behind a form of neocolonialism. I don't think it is an accident that the desegregation movement and the assimilationist movement in America parallel the neocolonial movement in Africa. As I often tell my classes, you as black students are now being educated to put a black face on white power and to help deceive your people into thinking because you got a job, we have moved forward as a people. Let's then just take a quick look at the functions of maladjustment and why you cannot get blacks, why it is important that blacks never get out of their sickness. You ever wondered why the more social workers you produce, the crazier people get? The more psychologists you produce, the crazier people get. Do you ever wonder about that? I lost a job challenging whites about that. Why you, as a white man, whom these crazy people have permitted to be chairman of the Department of Predominantly Hispanic and Black College, why do you, as a black man, a white man, continue to try to bring these psychologists in here when you know that this psychology is not doing the black and Hispanic community one whit of good? He could not disagree with that. How do you pretend to judge the qualifications of black people for teaching other black people and Hispanic teachers and Hispanic students, when you admit every day in the New York educational system that you don't know how to educate black children? We have a group of people who lament about their inability to educate black children, how black children are so-called uncontrollable and ineducable and all of that, and yet they want to sit on a board and determine who is qualified and not qualified. We have this insult downtown where these white dogs are going to try to determine who should be the chancellor of New York City schools, and yet have admitted that they cannot educate black children. And we'll sit there and let them try to lay the foundation and tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to be. How do you qualify to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to do? You have not demonstrated that you are capable of educating black people, but yet there are a lot of us who want to sit back and talk about standards and degrees and all this other nonsense that the people who've clearly admitted that they failed have laid upon us. And yet we have a lot of this going on in the system. But this kind of stuff must happen if black people are to continue to be subordinated. How is it functional? The captive African maladjustment justifies European dominance and exploitation. Because we are crazy, because we are criminals, because we are addicts, because we are that, the Europeans have a right to put their police in our community. They have a right to run the welfare agencies that keep us crazy, by the way. They have a right to intrude into our cultural families and personal lives. Why? Because, you see, they are maladjusted. They have learning deficiencies. They have this and that. Therefore, we're coming in to help and treat them in some sort of way. We are bringing in foreign aid. We are calling on the IMF to study and regulate their national economies and so forth. So you will see the so-called sickness and dependency and lagging in development and all of these other kinds of things every day are justifications for the Europeans to intrude upon African life and seek to control that life. And when we accept their definitions, we accept their dominance. We ask for their dominance, and we see their dominance as some kind of aid to us. Yet, when we look some 40 years later, we are in the same position or in a worse position than before. How do we solve it? Asking more of it. Well, let's get more degrees. Let's see that the teachers get more degrees. Even though the more degrees they get, the worse the education has become. But what's the solution? Send them back to school for some more. The more money that's been pumped into school, what happens? The worse education has got. What's the solution? Let's put more money into school. Idiotic solutions all over the place. But you see, you cannot expect a neurotic to think normally. That's the essence of being what? Neurotic. If you thought normally, behaved normally, you wouldn't be a neurotic, would you? So being maladjusted justifies European dominance, rationalizes Eurocentric treatment, as I just said, of African people, and thereby reduces their guilt and self-condemnatory feelings for behaving toward the African in ways contrary to their stated political and constitutional, ethical, moral, religious principles. You know, these great Christians and these great people who believe in equality. How do you believe in equality? You know, the greatest problem in this country was, how do you believe in the equality of man and yet enslave a group of men? How do you believe in this and mistreat and discriminate? In order to get out of that dilemma, then, you must make those people what? Less than men. Less than human. You see? So then in that way you can justify what you do. They're not fully human. They're not fully men. They're not fully intelligent. They're not fully capable of self-government. They're not fully capable of guiding themselves. Therefore, it's only incumbent on us, those of us who are lucky enough to be more intelligent and divinely sent to rule over men, to take care of them. It is incumbent upon us to take up what? The white man's burden, which happens to be the black man. But actually, the other way around is we have to carry them as a burden. The maladjustment of black people maintains Eurocentric self-esteem, self-definition and identity, self-concept, sense of security, and control. Since the captive African's debilitated state, debased and degraded nature will not permit him to successfully overcome such dominance. The lowest European on the lowest street, skid row in this country, can always say one thing, at least I'm not black. He defines himself and his self-esteem still rests upon the ultimate degradation of black people. So no matter how low and evil he sinks, he still has a superiority attitude toward black people. And therefore the degradation of black people and maintaining black people in that state is important to the European sense of self-esteem and self-identity. The European more or less defines himself in contrast to the African person. Many of you have run into Europeans, and when you came to be what they did not expect to be, you've seen them unravel before your very eyes. When they could not play their accustomed role of dominance and mastery, you've seen them become unglued and unable to function, to become confused. It means then that our submission and subordination and degradation keeps them together. And therefore, it is necessary for them to maintain this degraded state in black people in order to maintain their sense of self as a people. And by maintaining us in this debate, this debased state and degraded state, they therefore maintain their security, because as long as we think neurotically and maladjustedly, then we will not be able to think in a way that will ultimately defeat them as a people and ultimately destroy them as a people. And remember, we're talking about people who are a minority in the world and yet who must protect their interests. Black maladjustment induces induces the captive African to engage in self-defeating behavior, which relieves the Eurocentric establishment of having to impose direct militaristic oppression and to blame the victim for his own predicament. We get plenty of that, of course. In other words, when you get the black maladjusted to a certain degree, he will mistreat himself. Well, look, I put libraries in your community. You just don't like to read. We have schools here. You just like to drop out for some reason. The knowledge is available to you. You just don't like it for some reason or other. It's a very slick system because it permits the European to pretend that they are liberal and open and so forth, and yet at the same time maintain themselves. And of course, I often talk about this. The European talks about freedom of speech. But we are only free to speak when our audience does not hear us. We are only free to speak when our audience is not interested. We are only free to speak when the audience really does not listen. Oh, I can sit here and call Reagan all kind of names and talk about white folk. That illustrates what a great system we have here. But how is this possible? To a good extent, it's possible because, you see, at first you induce the audience not to be what? Interested, not to care or to be apathetic, and then you just let the person speak as long as they want to. You induce the audience not to be active, and therefore, knowing that after the speech is over, no real activity will take place, so you let them talk as much as they want to. So the system of slavery, you see, and Jim Crowism that occurred shortly thereafter, structured the black personality in such a way that despite the Marcus Garveys and the Malcolm X's and other people, there's been relatively little change, because the reception often of the audiences was such that they would not threaten the United States after they heard the speech. We are only free in this country to do the wrong thing. Recognize what happened to Farrakhan. Farrakhan has been saying the same thing for 20 years. But to a good extent, when the whites actually thought that black people might really be listening to Farrakhan, might really act upon what Farrakhan was saying, he can't now get into Javits Center. Now he's having a hard time finding a place to speak and a platform to speak to black people. Is this the country of free speech, ladies and gentlemen? You better not believe it. There's no way. We say we are free. What is freedom, we say? Freedom to do what we want to do. But stop a minute and think. What makes you want to do what you want to do? And you might come to realize then that our very wants and our very desires have been what? Induced. So that the things we really want and the things we really desire are those things that maintain the system and are those things that destroy us as a people. But yet we object to anyone speaking about it because we see our indulging in them as some expression of our what? Freedom. Yet in this system, when you so-called let a people free, and yet you must maintain them in subordination, they must then, with their freedom of choice, always choose what? The wrong thing. But you give them a foolish pride into thinking that since they have choice, they are therefore free. It's a very slick system. it induces the African, the captive African, to behave in such a way such that he will economically and otherwise and apparently of his own accord support the European establishment to the detriment of his own without being conscious of his doing so. Why should a black person be made to feel ugly? What is the function of associating blackness and ugliness, blackness and uncleanliness, blackness and unlovable? Is it just purely a racist attitude of some evil people? What do you do when you feel ugly or unkempt? But you do something else beside that. You go out and you buy yourself a new and spend a lot of money. But what's happening here? Who do you spend it with? Who gets the buck of the money that's spent? In other words, the African feeling ugly and unclean in his attempt to compensate for that feeling of ugliness and uncleanliness goes to the very person who made him feel that way in the beginning and purchases and buys from that person and therefore maintains the very individual that destroyed his self-image to start with. Do you think then an economic system that depends upon a bunch of people trying to compensate for feelings of inferiority by buying brand names? I don't know where brands, you know. By buying names of other people on their clothing? Do you think that system is ever really going to let you out of that feeling of ugliness? It can't. It's economically dependent upon that feeling, ladies and gentlemen. If we were made to feel naturally beautiful, don't you know we would destroy the cosmetics and industry? So we must feel naturally that nature itself has not made us beautiful, so that we must compensate for it. And therefore, we can see then that the inducement of inferiority in black people, the inducement of a feeling of ugliness, the inducement of these various negative feelings must stay in black people so that in trying to compensate for these feelings, black people will economically, politically, and otherwise support the very people that induced them. You see, the alienation of black people is economically functional. It's just not a feeling you have in your mind. The fact that you may wrestle with your own self-estrangement, separation from yourself, is not just a feeling you're having within yourself. It is a politically functional feeling. It is induced for political purposes. What does it mean to be alienated? To be alienated does not only mean that one suffers a split within the personality, that one feels estranged from himself, that one does not know himself. Certainly that's an aspect of alienation, and this is the way it's talked about in the psychology books, you see. And when you read all of this psychology, you think you're really getting heavy, you see, and the Eurocentrics teach it to you very directly, and you feel very profound when you talk about the great dynamics of the id and ego struggling with one another. Why do you alienate a person? We are alienated so that we can serve aliens. That is the function of alienation. Alienation means to be determined by forces outside oneself, other than oneself, to the enhancement of those aliens. When Marx talks about alienation, then, do not just cue in on the alienation that the worker feels. Recognize that the worker has to be alienated in order to serve the owner of the means of production. That's its ultimate function. You will recognize, then, an alienated people can only spend money with aliens. They can only support aliens. They can sit here and support these Koreans and these Arabs and these Indians and everybody else but a black person. They can support everybody's families but their own. They can give jobs to these people's uncles and aunts and sisters and brothers and children, but they cannot give jobs to their own children. They can feel good when they give all of their money to Bloomingdale's and these other places, but they feel cheated every time they trade with a black person. You have to be alienated for that reason. That's why we alienate. And do you think the white man intends to turn that feeling of alienation loose in your heart? You are dead wrong. No matter how often you go into a boardroom, no matter how high you move up into the white hierarchy, because alienation is functional for white power and functional for white economic, social, and political dominance. And yet I see somebody expressing surprise after 40 years that black children still have a sense of inferiority. Because you don't know your black psychology, and because you studied them from a Eurocentric psychological point of view, and because you saw your goal as not removing the white man from power, but of sleeping with him in his beds, and not questioning the evilness of his system, but of wanting to share in it. We never had a national debate. Who gave the NAACP the permission to go out to court and talk for black people in terms of equality? Equality with whom? We should have debated that. That's a moral issue. Equality with the slave master? Equality with exploiters? Equality with people who, every time they stepped on a continent, destroyed and degraded the people that they dealt with? Is this what we want, a sharing of the spoils, or is it that we want a whole different world than what these people have bought on this earth today? But we were diverted from asking that fundamental question. We were made to think simply because we were getting paid less than white folks, our problem would be solved merely by getting equal pay. But the problem is much deeper than that, ladies and gentlemen. But that too is a part of the illness, you see. So then the maladjustment is used and is induced in the African to engage in self-destructive behavior so that he may annihilate himself, or that his demise can be permitted or enacted without triggering Eurocentric guilt and without costly resistance. It was induced to permit the European to perceive himself as naturally superior, to protect the European from genetic annihilation. While I'm on that subject, let me just mention one quick thing here about genetic annihilation. Some of you saw this, I'm sure. U.S. News and World Report, June 22nd, 1987. What does it say here? Are we having enough babies? You know whose question that could be. Of course, this is a piece done by Ben Wattenberg. Some of you might have seen him at various places, and he's doing a very interesting thing now. He wrote a book called The Birth Dearth, indicating, of course, that not enough white people are being produced in the world. And so he starts here, what's happening today has never happened before. It will dramatically change the U.S. and the world in which we live. Over the years, I've heard businessmen, diplomats, government planners, and parents all begging for the same thing. No surprises, please. This book, A Speculation About the Future Based on Current Trends, is an attempt to deal with that plaint. Forewarned is forearmed. What is happening is this. For about a decade and a half, the peoples of the free, modern, industrial world, that includes the U.S., have not born enough children to reproduce themselves over an extended period of time. We had a baby boom. Now there is a birth dearth. I believe that the birth dearth will, in the near future, begin to cause turbulence at every level of our economy. I believe, too, that the birth dearth will leave in its wake tens of millions of unhappy adults who will end up with no children at all, or fewer children than they really wanted, or no grandchildren, or fewer grandchildren than they had hoped for. I believe the demographic and immigration patterns inherent in the birth dearth will yield an even smaller proportion of American of white European stock. This will likely cause more ethnic and racial tension and turmoil than otherwise would occur. That's what you see. People concerned with what? Their genes. Maintaining their ethnicity. Seeing it as an important fact and not trying to obliterate it the way we and our assimilationist people have tried to do. Not trying to forget who they are, but trying to hold on to their identity. This is one of the challenges of Afrocentric education, by the way. And one of the things that we have to look at, what would happen if these Europeans begin to disappear from the face of Earth? What will happen if they decide that they're not going to disappear and want to make some other people disappear? How are they going to deal with their low birth rate? What are the political implications about that situation? It has very serious implications for African people. And these people are now getting ready to deal with it. I believe further, he says, that the birth dearth may well turn out to be of great harm to the broadest value we treasure. It will make it difficult to promote and defend liberty in Western nations and the rest of the modernized world. Talking about white folks, certainly couldn't be talking about us in terms of liberty. Primacy and prosperity. And he's talking about here, we live in a community of free and modern nations banded together in a loose but real alliance. These nations like to argue. They argue about strategic defense, about who will buy cars from whom, and about whose wine shall be subject to what countervailing duties. But beneath the bickering, something remarkable has happened during the last four decades. This community of free modern nations has shaped and molded the nature of the entire world, a direct admission of their role in the world, you see. We've shaped and what? Created the world. Now that is being what? Threatened. And what are we going to do about maintaining it? You think that these people are going to let you free? You've got another thought coming. Economically, technologically, culturally, geopolitically, and in many ways, militarily as well. In other words, we've shaped it militarily as well. It's interesting sometimes when I see the Europeans talk about their boys being killed, and of course I was being killed along with them. They talk about Getz being robbed. And there are others being robbed. But remember one thing, if you're being held up out there in the streets by knife or gun, it's a gun you sold to them. And if black boys and white boys are being killed in Southeast Asia, 9 times out of 10, they are killed by weapons sold to the very people that are killing them. Ye that what lives by the sword shall what? Die by it. You think you can go around the world selling billions and millions of dollars of jet planes and weapons and not yourself ultimately be victimized by the very things you sell? These sellers of death will ultimately be the main victims of their own tools of death. By 1950, when this Western moment was in its early days, the population of the free modern world comprised about 22% of the global population. That's amazing even at that, isn't it? That 22% of the population could have control over another, what, 88%. Today we are 15%. By the year 2030 we will be 9%. A reasonable extrapolation through the end of the next century brings the Western proportion down to about what? 5%. But we still want to be in control. A question arises. Will our values continue to dominate in a world where our population shrinks to 9%, shrinks to 5%, even lower? And he goes on to talk about population and power. Can't you see again? Yeah, let's look up. I hope I'm not holding you up too long. I'll be too short. I just want to make a few other quotes from this. What happens when the West is less than 10% of the world, less than 5%? Do mere numbers of people equate with power and influence? Consider first the military situation. There are populous nations that are not big powers, China and India, but only populous nations can become big powers, the United States and the Soviet Union. The advantage of a large labor force and economies of scale are of vast importance. Brute economic production is one critical aspect of national strength and security. Larger populations can build more easily the infrastructure that supports national defense. And attaining technological leadership requires a large critical mass of scientists. Can we begin to see now why you cannot produce a large number of black engineers and technological people? Why the African world must remain ununited and disunited? Because these people recognize quite clearly that the uniting of African people the social organization of African people, the social and economic networking of African people, spells the end of European power and dominance. It's stated right here that, do you ever think, and I know it must have made you at times, of the influence that Jewish people have in the world? I read with great dismay here about 2 weeks ago the demands that they were laying on the Pope, you know, and how they had the Pope going. It's an interesting situation. And yet you think about it, there are only about, what, 15 million of them in the world? Maybe even less? And yet, you know, there's a major Jewish political organization in Washington that literally vetoes everything that the United States government does. That the United States budget itself is submitted to this organization. That this organization literally determines who and what nations and what groups will get what from this United States, even though this group is less than 3% of the United States population, ladies and gentlemen. It's an amazing situation there. Here are the people, population-wise, are smaller than a gnat. When you compare them with something like, what, 400 million or more African people, are more than a half billion Indian people, more than about a billion Chinese, and you can name one major population after another, and yet these billions somehow are unable to control their circumstances, and a tiny little group is able to literally manipulate this country and influence what goes on in the world. Reminds me of something some of you read today in today's New York Times. You heard about Mr. Le Pen over there in France, running for office, very famous, because he wants to run the Africans and the Asians out of France. Wasn't doing too bad either. Jean-Marie Le Pen, France's leading far-right politician and candidate for the French presidency, has caused an uproar with a statement that the Nazi gas chambers were a minor point of history. No problem until he mentioned that. Several political figures said that they would even vote to lift Mr. Le Pen's parliamentary immunity so that a defamation lawsuit could be brought against him. Political analysts and politicians said this was the first major slip, note that his first major slip now, by Mr. Le Pen, whose political campaign focuses on reducing the number of Africans, African Asians, and Arab immigrants to keep France French. So that wasn't his first major slip. It was only when he related to the Jews that he really made it, and that really cooked his goose. As long as he inveighed against Africans and others, as long as he talked about keeping them out and denying them, no problem. As a matter of fact, he was ascending in French politics. As long as he wanted to keep French, French, all of France, French, and all of that, no problem. No major issue. I mean, no major slip. But as soon as he said this business about the gas chambers and how Jews were executed might be a minor point in history, he was in serious trouble. This is the first major mistake Mr. Le Pen has committed, because these ideas that everyone thought, these are the ideas that everyone thought were dead. Political analysts also said Mr. Le Pen's remarks would probably make it harder for Mr. Chirac's coalition to agree to cooperate with Mr. Le Pen to help defeat the Socialist Party in next year's election. In other words, you see, you can help determine the shape of our government as long as you stay off the large majorities in the world. And you, I mean, just stay off of the what? The minority, the true minority in the world. As long as you can defame black people and African people, you can help determine the shape of the European government, of the French government. But as soon as you then talk about a very small minority in the world, you have made a major, major misstep, and you will pay for it. A very interesting kind of situation there. However, despite all of this, they ultimately recognize that if large populations were truly to unite and were truly to develop a national consciousness, were truly to approach the world in terms of cultural and nationalistic interest, they recognize ultimately then the power would have to shift. And of course we know then that is one of the major reasons why the European must minorize large groups of people and must make people who are ethnically the same think of themselves as being ethnically different. On a larger consumer market, only a larger consumer market can support, support much broad-based industrial scientific innovation, which often spins off into the military field. And he goes on and talks about, and culture counts. Values count. If the peoples of the world admire Western values and seek to adopt them, we are what? Stronger and safer. So you think then, with this kind of attitude, that African values will be permitted to flourish among African people if we leave it up to them to determine what values are there? There is another thing to be poor. Blacks and Hispanics have higher fertility rates than whites, although middle-class blacks have lower fertility rates than middle-class whites. Very interesting situation there as well. Have we, as black people, been so concerned with living in a European lifestyle that we've given up reproduction?
No.
Yet, many of us who are in the so-called middle class have done exactly that. This situation also illustrates the very deadly nature of European society and its very opposition to African values. You must recognize when you read Freudian psychology, at the bottom of that psychology is the critique of European society. A society that comes to hate sex, a society that sees sexuality as its enemy, as in opposition to civilization, a society that denies its gods sex and sexuality, is a society ultimately that's going to be a deadly one. How can you have fear and hatred and antipathy toward the very source of life and not ultimately side with death itself? And I think one of the major reasons this society has become deadly and a threat to the life of the very world itself is that it has problems with its own sexuality. And it has problems with the very basic nature of man. It has such a problem then that those who have the most to give to children, you would think, in terms of wealth, knowledge, and so forth, are the very ones that what? Do not have them. There's a problem there, ladies and gentlemen. And it's interesting to note then that this is diametrically opposed to the African sense and to African values that look at life and growth and development as a great value. But yet we note as African adopts these European values, they will also adopt the deadly nature of Europeans to the point often of killing their own children or denying them birth or denying them conception in the first place. And now the European is beginning to see the result of the philosophy that they have put forth. What happens in America? He goes, and it's interesting to note that this is one of the challenges. Further, recent immigrants have higher fertility rates than other Americans. By the way, some of you might have read 2 or 3 years ago about the Browning of America. The idea that the Hispanics are moving in so rapidly that at the rate they are going, they'll soon be America's largest minority. There will be more Hispanics in this country than blacks. And that at the rate they are going, we'll literally have a brown America. That's a major question we have to deal with too, ladies and gentlemen, by the way. What will happen to the black population in this country as it is outnumbered by the Hispanic population? Or as it is balanced off by Asians?